Ryerson, the Greater Toronto Area, and the whole world react to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
The U.S. and its allies scrambling to respond to Putin's aggression.
Hopes of a ceasefire appear to have suffered a setback.
Thousands of people in Toronto are rallying to show their support to Ukraine.
On February 24th, Vladimir Putin unleashed war on democratic Ukraine under the pretense that Russia needed to denazify the country. This claim was an attempt to discredit the country's leadership, portraying it as merely a puppet government.
But those were just excuses. The truth is, Putin has constantly had issues, and they have been simmering in the background of the Western consciousness since the 2014 annexation of Crimea. The apparent justification of this year's invasion was that modern, Western-leaning Ukraine was a constant threat, and Russia could not feel safe, develop, or exist amid Ukraine's growth with NATO, the Western alliance of 30 member states that Russia has long felt conflicted about.
The bad blood between these countries goes back to Ukraine's independence in 1991. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO expanded, eventually taking in most of the European nations that had formerly existed in a communist hold.
This shift brought NATO much closer to Moscow. Multiple NATO countries directly border Russia, and this kept, at best, a volatile peace.
Which was broken in 2008. When NATO announced plans to enroll Ukraine in its alliance, Russia felt threatened. According to the New York Times, Putin called the expansion menacing, insisting that Ukraine is historically and fundamentally a part of Russia.
Putin's complaints about NATO have only grown more extreme as his army has grown. We can't tell the future, but a Ukrainian history expert says that the roots of this conflict go back decades. An international diplomacy expert fears how this is affecting the psychology of Ukrainian citizens. And a Ukrainian-Canadian protest organizer just hopes that people keep paying attention to Ukraine's interests as the crisis progresses.
One thing most experts do agree on is that the consequences of this conflict will persist for years. I'm Alexandra Cleland.
And I'm Tom Desarmeaux. This is On the Record. This episode was recorded on the traditional and current Indigenous territories that include the Huron-Wendat, Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and the Mississaugas of the New Credit.
Last December, Russia presented NATO and the United States with a set of written demands that were required to ensure its security. Russia wanted a guarantee that Ukraine would never join NATO. It wanted NATO to draw down its forces in its Eastern European member countries, including Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. It also demanded that a 2015 ceasefire in Ukraine be implemented.
In January, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov told U.S. officials that Russia has no plans to invade Ukraine. NATO placed forces on standby the next day, including the U.S. ordering 8,500 troops in the United States to be ready to deploy. In February, Russia invaded. Now it's all at war. Bombs have been dropped on hospitals, theaters, and apartment complexes, and more than 2 million Ukrainian children have been displaced by the fighting. The invasion threatens to destabilize the volatile post-Soviet region with serious consequences for the security structure that has governed Europe since the 1990s.
Amid tentative peace talks, additional discussions took place between Ukraine and Russia on April 1st, with ongoing economic sanctions amping up pressure as Russians feel the impact of inflation, pushing the cost of household staples up. But with all these things changing across Europe, it's hard for anyone to make sense of things.
In the month since Russia invaded Ukraine, entire cities have fallen. Hospitals and condos have been bombed, and economic crises have run rampant in the country.
Each new detail, some horrifying, some haunting, have been witnessed by people around the world, including in Canada, where Ukrainians, Russians, and other supporters of democracy have kept a steady presence in major cities, demanding more diplomatic punishments for Russia's leaders, more munitions, the enforcement of a no-fly zone over Ukraine. An initial demonstration on February 27th attracted thousands of people who marched from Yonge and Dundas Square to Nathan Phillips Square in downtown Toronto. Marta Masny is a teacher and a former Ryerson student. She's a proud member of the Ukrainian-Canadian community and was among the crowd at the protest, shouting and chanting along with drummers through the streets of Toronto. At that time, the invasion had only begun 3 days before. As of that day, Google had just cut ties with Russian businesses, and the U.S. was vowing to crack down on the country's leaders' dirty money.
Growing up in Toronto, there is a very large Ukrainian community, and Ukrainians are known to be very united through Ukrainian school or through scouting groups that would be connected to other Ukrainians that are in Canada.
Marta says that Ukrainians have been touched to see Canada's support, but that the situation in Europe still takes a heavy toll.
It's been overwhelming support. I have had many people in the Ukrainian community and also outside of the Ukrainian community kind of ask and check up on what's going on and wanting to know what they can do to help or wanting to know the most recent news that's been happening. So the response has been overwhelmingly positive, which is great to see, great to experience. I really wish that I didn't have to deal with this right now, because it's like, why does Ukraine have to go kind of through a war for everything positive to happen?
Close to 4 million Ukrainians are estimated to have fled the country as of late March, according to the United Nations. Nearly 3,000 Ukrainians are estimated to have been killed, although it is difficult to get up-to-date calculations on casualties. Of those casualties, 700 are presumed civilians. NATO estimates suggest that there have been at least 7,000 Russian military deaths. The ongoing war has caused thousands to leave their homes. Some have fled the country altogether, becoming refugees in neighboring countries like Poland. Many who haven't yet fled the country are gathering in Lviv, a western Ukrainian city with a population of nearly 700,000. There are currently some 200,000 refugees in Lviv, which, as independent Canadian journalist Christopher Curtis describes it, is an almost bifurcated existence.
You have, like, life going on at a normal pace, or at least whatever passes as normal during war. Cafes are open, people take the bus to work, people are in shopping malls when some stores are open. You know, but at the same time, the economy's been devastated. There's tons of unemployment. People are trading their currency for foreign currency because it's more stable than the hryvnia, which is Ukraine's currency. And so it's interesting to see, you know, and as all this is happening, there's checkpoints everywhere. There's men holding Soviet-era Kalashnikovs in soldiers in sneakers. There's like, it's kind of a surreal scene.
Curtis spent a week reporting from Lviv, one of the major cities through which Ukrainian refugees would flee the war and escape into Poland.
You see the best and the worst of humanity. You know, you see people who bravely decided to leave a city under siege, survive airstrikes from Russia, survive machine gun fires from Russian positions when they would get in their cars and leave. You know, some people had to drive through the night on country roads without their headlights on to hide. So there's an incredible resilience. And, you know, it was mostly sort of mothers and grandmothers and some grandfathers carrying kids across the country while they would leave behind all of the sort of the fighting age men and some people who were even older than fighting age, you know, men in their 60s and even in their 70s. They would leave them behind to either do their military service or help the cause however they can, volunteering.
Every day, citizens are subject to danger from aircraft fire and have trouble securing reliable sources of food and currency. It is also difficult for some to secure reliable information about the war occurring all around them. Vladimir Putin's Russia is well practiced at pushing false narratives about its actions through TV, print media, and social media. Putin himself worked for 15 years as an intelligence officer in the KGB, the Soviet Union's notorious security agency. Many believe that this influences his views on information and foreign policy. Examples of this misinformation include social media posts claiming to show American forces dropping into Ukraine, which are actually taken from old training exercises. Experts say that misleading photos, videos, and online profiles are common tactics within Russia's wartime strategy and have been used during other conflicts, like the war in Syria.
This misinformation has become one of the most pressing issues in this war. With access to so much information at our fingertips, thanks to technology, many people may find it difficult to filter through truth and inaccuracies. Anatoly Gruzd is a Ryerson professor specializing in information technology. He recently co-created a project with the university that tracks and aggregates misinformation about the war in Ukraine. He's also a Ukrainian Canadian with friends and relatives still living in the country.
There are many of us like this with ties, formal, informal, direct, indirect ties to Ukraine. So certainly we want to see Ukraine prosper, be strong ally and partner to Canada. So from that perspective, it's important for Canada to help as much as we can.
This war has ignited an unprecedented 21st century humanitarian crisis. The United Nations says that it is preparing for the possibility that 7 million people will be displaced.
Chile Eboe Osuji, a distinguished international jurist, now with the Ryerson Law School, is deeply familiar with the effects of war. He lived through the Nigerian Civil War in the late 1960s. The war lasted for 3 years, displaced more than 2 million Nigerians, and caused a famine which killed millions more. Eboe Osuji worked on a case against the perpetrators of the Rwandan genocide and in 2010 served as a lead prosecutor of former Liberian President Charles Taylor for war crimes committed in Sierra Leone. For nearly a decade before his 2021 departure, he was a scholar and a judge at the International Criminal Court. As head of the only institution with the power to prosecute international offenses like genocide and war crimes, he understands the significance of war's effects on citizens.
It's not easy to quantify that kind of effect, but let's put it this way. At best, it suspends life, and at worst, it destroys life for the duration of the conflict and beyond that. It also damages the environment in both obvious and non-obvious ways. You cannot enjoy your right to life, liberty, and security of the person where there's a raging war. That's out of the question. Infrastructure is damaged. There is no economic life. So it is not easy to begin even to comprehend how this affects human life. We watch it on TV, but you need to be there to experience it.
Conflicts like the war in Ukraine consume every part of people's lives. Citizens lose their homes, are forced from their cities and towns, lose their lives or the lives of family members. There are also less evident consequences to war, though, that are hard to appreciate until years later.
All those bombs that create craters in farm fields and homes, they will unleash some toxic waste and chemicals. That is one of these lighter things that can happen. Beyond that, you also see the knock-on economic consequences, the direct economic consequences that this war portends for the world. In Nigeria, the Igbo side is saying that the person that's holding somebody underground is also underground with that. So if you're a wrestler, if you give somebody a pinfall, you're going to leave the person a pinfall and move on. No, you need to be there to hold them down. And that is what these economic sanctions will do.
Many have viewed Putin's actions over the last month as irrational. He doesn't seem to mind the potential damage he is doing to his own country. His actions on behalf of Russia have caused thousands of casualties and global condemnation, leading the West to levy crippling sanctions on the country's economy. This hasn't caused the president to back down at all. He's still continuing to use his old tactics of using propaganda networks to push misinformation to cover up Russian losses.
This is why Gruz thinks tackling misinformation is so important.
So during the war, just like during the pandemic, there's a high level of uncertainty in the society. So people don't really know what to trust, what to believe in, and access to the accurate information and timely information is critical during these times, like what we see in Russian invasion in Ukraine, because it may save people's lives. So you need to know where to stay, when and where is to go. When there's sirens going on, you need to know what your government is telling you, especially in these circumstances where television might not work because it was destroyed. So you really have to turn to online sources such as social media to get that type of information. And of course, if you're exposed to inaccurate, misleading, false information, then you can put yourself and others around you in danger.
Vazny says this is something Ukrainians have been warning about for years.
anything that comes out of Putin's mouth is a lie. Russia has built up a very strong propaganda machine, and people in Russia are being fed it every single day. And they're targeting countries outside of Russia now to buy into that propaganda. So definitely do not trust Russian media.
Russians are not completely unaware of what's going on. Since February 24th, thousands of Russian citizens have taken to the streets to protest the war at great personal risk. This does not seem to have had great effect on Putin's decisions, though. The country's overall aggressive attitude has caused U.S. and NATO leaders to fear the outbreak of a larger war in Europe, one that could include the use of nuclear or biological weapons.
Arne Kislenko is a Ryerson history professor. His work focuses on subjects like war, espionage, and the history of Europe. He agrees that the world is in a very dangerous situation and believes that in order to understand this conflict, we have to think about it within the entire scope of Eastern European history, not just by picking an arbitrary point to begin, like February's invasion. Russian aggression and its use of targeted misinformation goes back decades. During the 2014 presidential protests and subsequent invasion of Crimea, the Kremlin pumped out misinformation to change the narrative around Ukraine's government and what its people were demanding.
So 2014, the trajectory of Ukraine has been distinctly different. Certainly Russian manipulations after the 1990s, all the way up to 2014, were designed to install a very pro-Russian government in Ukraine, in Kyiv. And that had some success over the years, but then ultimately changed in 2014 when the last of the Russian pro-Russian forces was more or less dislodged. Since then, you've had a Ukraine that is on a trajectory for being a much more open, democratic state, one that is inclined towards the West.
Kislenko sees the possibility of Ukraine joining NATO as a line in the sand for Putin. Not only would NATO's geographical positioning pose security risks in Putin's mind, but would signal a continued shift away from Russian influence on the world, possibly jeopardizing the president's firm grip on power.
All of those things, have been hard to swallow from a Russian perspective, represent threats from a Russian perspective. We have trouble understanding that here in the West, but that is certainly his narrative. And then, I think in that milieu, that the idea of an independent, democratic Ukraine is something that he cannot possibly tolerate. And that's because it is way too close to home, not just geographically and culturally, if you like, but in the sense that would likely stimulate dissent in his own country.
It's hard to predict the future of these two countries. Russia's recent agreement to carry out peace talks is proving to be less promising than many hoped. The tension caused between Russia and NATO because of this war is making people fear a nuclear confrontation to a degree not thought possible since the end of the Cold War. Kislenko says that Russia has never really been a transparent country. What free press existed inside the country has been shut down over the course of this invasion. Many feel that the Russian people do not have an accurate sense of what's going on.
Putin employs a vast network of TV stations, print media, hackers, and online social media campaigns in an attempt to control what his citizens know and what they believe. Curtis says that in his time in Ukraine, he even encountered people who would speak to relatives in Russia, and they refused to believe that their country was shelling cities or killing civilians. One woman had a daughter-in-law and grandchildren across the border. When she spoke to them on the phone, they claimed what she said wasn't true, and that, if it were, the aggression must have been somehow necessary. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that he's prepared to discuss the country adopting a neutral stance between NATO and Russia as part of a peace deal.
There is a second round of peace talks going on in Istanbul, but there are doubts about whether the Kremlin is serious about any kind of armistice. Although Russian representatives have discussed moving troops away from cities like the capital city of Kyiv and Mariupol, the numbers of forces actually retreating are proving operationally irrelevant, and shelling continues.
Wars galvanize people, Kislenko says, especially in countries like Canada, where the Russian and Ukrainian diasporas are substantial. There are 500,000 Canadians of Russian descent. There are 1.4 million of Ukrainian ancestry, which is the largest population outside of Russia and Ukraine itself.
And it is a call to action, and it is a lightning rod.
Perhaps, Kislenko thinks, it's also a miscalculation on the part of President Putin.
I don't think he fully understood how Ukrainians envision themselves, which is unbelievable to say, because you would think he at least entertained that notion, but evidently he did, and he doesn't understand the power of what it is he's done in terms of galvanizing response from the Ukrainian people internationally.
The path to peace is likely a long one. Ivoy Osuji believes that this situation requires commitment from Canadians.
It requires courage, political courage, on the part of leaders of countries who are now upset by what is going on. It also requires pressure from citizens everywhere to make their governments do the right thing.
Many commentators seem skeptical of the effectiveness of these peace talks. International pressure seems to be having an influence on Putin's decisions. European and North American countries have been by and large united in their condemnation and active sanctioning of Russia. That being said, possible strengthened ties between Putin's government and the People's Republic of China could prove disruptive to any kind of legitimate pressure on Russia. With all these global uncertainties swirling, it's hard to predict what long-term consequences a long-term war will have on the world.
It is a big question in the sense that we don't really know. So let me preface it by saying that, you know, a lot of experts on this part of the world, or experts on Putin or whatever, myself included, we got it wrong in a lot of ways. Right. And that's an important thing to map out. It doesn't mean that every commentary is useless. That would defeat the purpose of this interview, amongst other things. But we got it wrong in the sense that I think for many years, a lot of people were, myself included, were thinking that Putin was evil, dangerous in some respects, and certainly not a nice fellow, but that he was a reasonably logical player in his own mind. There is an accounting for one's logic or rationality, even if you don't like their point of view, right? You don't understand them. And that would imply that all the things he's done over the last 20 years have been quite calculated, that, you know, he's always sort of one step ahead. He's always thinking. I think that may have been true for some things that he's done over the last 20 years, but evidently not in the last couple of weeks. And so why is that an answer to your question? Well, what it means is that we now have to put so many different things on the table that previously we didn't. So I think people need to understand that while this is not necessarily the end of all life on the planet, right? I don't want to start pushing those kind of buttons, but, you know, this has all the ingredients to get very ugly, much uglier than it's already been.
Regardless of what happens with peace talks, besieged cities, and troop reversals, the global community seems intent on continued solidarity with the Ukrainian people. In Toronto, we've seen massive youth-organized protests in the downtown area, and students' clubs at Ryerson and U of T are continuing to organize fundraisers and additional demonstrations.
For On the Record, I'm Alexandra Cleland.
And I'm Tom DeZarmo.
This episode of the On the Record podcast was produced by Tom DeZarmo, Alexandra Cleland, TJ Deer, and Ariel Brooks.